Now we will go with the gentleman speaker. Bob is another long-term member of Overeaters Anonymous. He's been in the program since 1996. Bob's story is similar to many people. He lost a lot of weight, gained the weight back, lost the weight again, but has been abstinent since 1998. Bob comes to us by way of New York. Well, actually Ohio and then New York, and then his job took him from New York to Missouri. So he's getting closer to us all the time. His big passion, like Bev's, I found this amazing, is also baseball. Only he has different teams that he likes. And I said, well, you couldn't have moved to a better place. He's halfway between Kansas City and St. Louis, so he can take his choice or visit them both. Bob has also done a lot of service in OA. He's held several positions. He's very active in Overeaters Anonymous. He may not remember this, but I met him last summer where he had traveled. He was traveling the country just kind of going, doing OA and going to baseball games and showed up at the Iowa State Convention. And I just was amazed by that he would just, you know, go all over and just go to our different conventions and that type of thing. So, he has a lot to share. He has a very good story also, so please help me welcome Bob.
Raise the microphone just a little bit here. My name's Bob Lindsay, and I am a compulsive overeater. And Bev, I want to thank you so much. It's amazing when I came here how I thought everything was, you were all so different. You know, I was the only one out of the 6 billion people on this planet that felt the way I did and had all these problems. And actually, of course, the first meeting I went to, there was no men there. And we are outnumbered, and it has nothing to do with need or the way this disease afflicts us. You know, we're just more stubborn than the other half of our species. But I related so much when you started talking about how you felt and your self-image. I related so much, and the fact that you grew up on a farm and I came out of a city and moved to bigger cities the geographic issues really aren't significant. So I'm not alone, and I'm not so different. And I can not only look you in the eye, I can look myself in the mirror today, and that's because what this fellowship has given me. I'll get the details out of the way. I was born in 1951 in Cleveland, Ohio. I'll let you do the math. I came to Overeaters Anonymous. My life has taken me from Cleveland to the Bronx borough of New York City, and then Albany, New York, and Buffalo, and now Missouri. It was when I landed in Albany that I think I had reached a pit. I'm not one of these people that, I'm not going to tell you that I came here because of doctor's warnings or, you know, the consequences of this disease. I know a lot of people do. I can tell you why I didn't have doctor's warnings, because I didn't go to a doctor. I didn't want to be told, you know. I mean, I hear other people say, well, my doctor says I should lose weight. Well, I wasn't going to have that happen because I wasn't going to go near a doctor. I weighed somewhere in the neighborhood, and I say in the neighborhood because I kept throwing scales out. I think I weighed about 265 pounds when I got here. And my way of the games I played involved, when I know I ate too much, I'd run home and I'd jump on the scale and see. Well, see, I didn't cause that much damage, you know. The bottom line is, you know, our intoxication is cumulative, you know. alcoholic, which I am as well. I learned that once I've got here. You know, we can go out and drink, and I'll get drunk same night, but I'll sober up tomorrow. My intoxication was very much cumulative here, and I didn't get to be 265 pounds by one good binge on the town. You know, it was continual. I was, you know, yet I not only would I lie to myself, I would lie to the people around me. I'm one of these people that if I went out to eat with you, and that was what I did a lot. I don't think I cooked a meal at home 30 years maybe. I remember that when I first left, got out of my parents' house, my cousin and I shared an apartment, and we were doing some cooking, but I wasn't very good at doing dishes. And, you know, the place basically, I hate to tell you, but two, you know, just barely out of their teens guys, what the place looked like. And when my aunt came over one day, absolutely threw a fit when she saw the place. That was my excuse. I didn't cook another meal. I was about 21, 22 years old, and you know, I lived in the middle of the city, and I just ate every meal out, and that's where I was when I got here. I was so self-conscious about the weight, and with me, since I'm not a very physically active person even today. I'm not one of these people that try to work the weight off. Believe me, I'm just too damn lazy for that. You know, so it was in my face and it was in my gut, and I wouldn't make the concession that I was fat. I wore size 38 jeans. Well, I have to tell you, when you've got about 100 too many pounds on you, size 38 jeans don't cut it. You know, and it's going to go somewhere, and it went, you know, went right out in front. Like my cousin said to me one day when I was in my late 20s when it really started to get noticeable, he said, "I see you got a Dunlop, Bob." And I looked at him like, what are you talking about? He says, "Yeah, your stomach Dunlopped over your belt." You know? And I felt the intense shame and, you know, a flush, and I wasn't one to, I didn't know how to respond or retaliate or anything, and I just felt that embarrassment, and that was how I felt about life in general. It was, I just didn't think I fit in. If you really knew me, and if you really saw how I felt, you wouldn't want me around. I'm standing here today telling you how awful this awful self-view, and it's not because of anything that's happened to me. I can't sit here and tell you that I was mistreated. I grew up in a loving home. My parents were neither overeaters or drinkers. They were positive. They tried to. We grew up in the suburbs of Cleveland, if someone were, you know, doing my biography, they'd say, "What do you got to complain about?" You know, I got out of high school and I went to work on the railroad, and made good money from the start. I enjoy railroading; it's a hobby with me as well. So I've got no reason, you know. Today I look back; there's no reason for me to have been sitting there depressed. I too thought of killing myself with a knife, and the thought came to me that I would probably make a mess of it more than, it's just, there's no reason for this other than the fact that I know today that I had no God in my life. You know, my parents, they tried to introduce me to the religion of their upbringing, and I fought them tooth and nail, and they were smart. They knew a losing battle, and they let go. And my vision and my view of God and religion when I got here was that perhaps they hadn't you know, man hadn't explained the whole, the universe and the stars and that, but, you know, so maybe there was some being or something responsible for all of this. But when someone here suggested that there is a God out there that is personal to you and cares about you, I shut them right off. You know, that I didn't believe that. Today, thankfully, by doing this work, I've come to find that power in my life today, and He's got a purpose for me. You know, He gives it to me on a need-to-know basis. You know, I'm one of these people that when I've finally been told to do things here and I finally conceded, I've had sponsors, and thank God for blunt sponsors from Boston. My first sponsor and my current sponsor are both from Boston. And what can I say? They hear nonsense come out of my mouth and they tell me about it. And I also have to say thank you to the AAs in Cleveland. They don't believe in killing us with kindness either. You know, they're very good at, you know, my first sponsor, when we first got together, I don't want to jump around too much. Let me tell you how I got to that point where I took a sponsor. As Laura said, I came here in 1996, but I'm a little stubborn, so it didn't take. I came to the rooms. The day I reached out was in February of 1996, and I was sitting home. I was off from work because I'd been in a minor auto accident. There was three of us in a car. Now one of my best friends got medevac down to Westchester County and was off work for a year. And I just had, my legs were bruised up, and my other buddy got a couple of cracked ribs. But I'm sitting there feeling sorry for myself. I wasn't thinking about my friend or his, you know, and his wife and five kids at home or anything. I'm sitting home feeling sorry for myself, laying on my back. I had decided at that moment, I made one of these decisions, but I didn't know how to take actions, but I made a decision to go on a diet again. Now, I've had experience with diets. I did the first one when I was 30 years old. I was only maybe about 35 pounds overweight, and I lost about 35 pounds in 35 days, you know. And boy, I tell you, I'm so proud of myself. I broke my arm patting myself on the back after that. And I proved, that's what I thought, I proved to myself that I can do this. I can do this by myself. You know, I don't need anyone. I didn't know anything about OA at the time. Now, I had been taken to AA meetings back starting around that same time, and that's another, a whole other story. I thought people were just feeling sorry for poor, pitiful, lonely Bob and kind of tagged me along. And I know today that people don't normally call up their non-alcoholic friends and say, come to a meeting with us. You know? But it took me quite a few more years before that sunk in too. But I did a diet. I started buying diet books. And I'm one of these people, I tend towards the self-righteous, and I said, well, I don't do fad diets. You know, I would view with indignance when people would talk about all these fads, you know. So I would go out and bought books like Atkins or Pritikin. I don't know. I got a whole rack at home. I call it my memorial book rack. And it's part of the process for me of never wanting to forget what I was doing. They gathered dust, mind you. But the second time I tried this, because naturally after I lost that 35 pounds, what usually happens? You know, I'm fixed, thank you. And went right back to where I was, and naturally I put that on, the 35 pounds back on, and more. And so the next time I tried it, I went 9 days, and I didn't lose at all in 9 days, but I'll tell you what, when I eat right, I feel good. It's amazing how quickly, but I couldn't do it, you know, because I wasn't doing anything about how I felt inside, and the food was the pacifier. The food was taking my mind off of it. The last time I tried it was 4 days. But this particular day in February, I said, I'm going to do this again, and I couldn't even start. I've never had, I don't want to forget that day. It's not the physical. I don't even have pictures of what I looked like back then. I was so ashamed. It's not the physical that part of it that I don't want to forget. I don't want to forget how I felt that day in February. And I believe that was the first time in my life that God entered my life. I just kept them at arm's length. But I picked up the phone that day, and I called this friend of mine. One of the guy with had the two cracked ribs. He'd been in the car with us, and I thought back on it. Why did I call him? He was this guy was skinny as a rail, never had a food problem. He said he was an alcoholic, and I'd worked with him. But I didn't believe that. To me, an alcoholic was someone that had two drinks and they were slurring their speech. You know, that was I had a very narrow definition of what an alcoholic was. But what I did notice about him is when I worked with him years ago, I'd worked in a little town called Toledo, Ohio, and he was he looked the same, but he was very angry person. And 15 years later, when he showed up in Albany, New York, where I was living at the time, he looked the same, but he wasn't angry anymore. Absolute 100-degree change in his whole demeanor. And I called him up that day, and I told him how at wit's end I was. And he said, well, I've heard ladies in my meetings talk about Overeaters Anonymous. Now, the minute he said that the solution, the minute he talked solution, I started throwing up roadblocks. Like, well, where do I find him? Now, I know he was doing his level best not to give me a sarcastic answer. So the way he put it to me is, well, he says, they usually have hotline numbers. See if we can find it and, you know, look it up in the phone book. And I did. Now I'm trapped, you know. So I looked the number up, I dialed it, the number had been disconnected. So I said, well, that wasn't meant to be. Now you remember I said I'm the most, about as godless as they came, yet that wasn't meant to be. Who was I talking to? Well, about an hour later, my buddy called me back and he said, how'd it go? And I gave him that line and he said, well, which phone book do you have there? And I gave him a sarcastic answer. And he said, well, I just got this new book in the mail today. And he looked it up. He said, was this the number? And I kind of grudgingly said, no. long story short, I ended up 2 miles down the road and at 5 o'clock that evening at St. Peter's Hospital. Now, my expectation was to slither into a room about this size with probably about twice as many people in it, because that was the two AA meetings I'd been taken to. They were full, like I just hid in the back. No one made me say anything. Well, I walked in that room that day, and there was four skinny ladies there. Now, I've been to a lot of OA meetings. Just think of the odds of that happening even today. But I do remember one lady kept saying, there's a lot of hope here. A lot of hope here, and I almost at that point I wish she'd stop saying that. It's like I didn't understand hope. I didn't obviously didn't have any in my life, but They talked about what they did. I was pretty thick at the time. I probably still am pretty thick. I'm a slow learner, but what I did here is they went to a lot of meetings. And I think what happened is I did what I was able to hear or ingest at that moment. Like Bev talked about, you know, she reads this book and it's like, where did that come from? Did they change it? Did they change this? Well, I just didn't absorb a lot, but I went to a lot of meetings, and I think the key to it was, is as long as I did all that I was able to consciously absorb, I got relief. And in the 5 months from that first meeting, I lost 90 pounds, and I was, not much else had changed. You know, someone said do 90 and 90, and I was going to show you how, you know, I was going to out 90 and 90 it all, and I did 120 in 90, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days. They talk about doing that. But as long as I was doing what I was capable of understanding, I had that success. And, well, I don't need to tell you what happened to my ego. The weight, I said at that time that the weight was lost. It wasn't lost. It just shifted upstairs, you know. And I went back to work after I was off for a couple months, and I went back to work, and I'm getting all these oohs and ahs, and, oh, you look great, and you lost. Oh, how'd you do it, Bob? And, oh, it was like, and I have to tell you, I was not in a mindset where I could say that, fellas, it wasn't me. It was the grace of God that expressed himself to me in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous. And I have to tell you that I was not able to say that when I walked into the railroad yard office, you know. So I let them pump my ego up, and eventually I started hearing people talk about what else they did, you know, other disciplines they did. As I said, I lived in Albany, New York. We're about 180 miles west of Boston. And there was people that had eliminated flour and sugar from there. And there was other people that were weighing and measuring their food and doing exactly the disciplines you talked about. Calling the sponsor, writing it down and calling the sponsor every day. And I'm sitting there thinking, thank God I don't have to do that. Look at me. And, you know, and I believe about 5 months into this, I started playing games. I started experimenting and picking up food. And I found out that the first person that I lied to, and I could lie to you all pretty good, you know, but the first person I lied to was myself. You know, I didn't run right into McDonald's, you know. I started with, whole wheat bagels, you know. No one around me is ever going to say anything if I pick up a whole wheat bagel, you know. Or fat-free, sugar-free frozen yogurt, you know. But I got to tell you that no matter how wholesome it sounds, if you eat enough of this stuff, you're going to gain weight. They can serve the most wholesome meal there is, and I will gain weight because I have an allergy, and this is where I relate so much to what Silkworth talks about, is that my body does something different. I don't get a shut-off signal. The average person, I've been to some banquets recently, and I watch people, they serve them a big opulent meal, and an hour later, half the food is still sitting there. Or people are drinking, you know, and they sip on a drink, and an hour later, half the drink is there. And I don't identify at all, you know, because my body does not give me a shut-off signal. That's why I know today that I'm a compulsive overeater, is because I can't stop once I start. And it's not just the sugar and the flour. So today for me, everything that goes into my body is committed and weighed and measured. And I just know I need to do that. I need to have that definition, because if I start playing the games again, what I get back, it's not going to be Fat Bob overnight. You know, again, it takes us longer to get drunk with this disease, but it takes us a hell of a lot longer to sober up. But what I do get back, I got back when I started playing the games back in 96, was I got back the mindset. And I became a bigger fake and a bigger liar. And I was coming to meetings and trying to make you think everything was okay and that I was Mr. Away and everything, when I was, again, I was dying inside again. And that brought me to the point where I was on August 29th of 1998. And there's not a shred of doubt in my mind, again, that there was a God in my life, because I didn't know how to say, help me. But what I did do, the concession I did make, was, I don't know if you use these pre-printed We Care lists that World Service sends out, but they have two columns under sponsorship: can sponsor or need a sponsor. Now, I, at that point in time, I'd been leaving both blank, because I knew I was too much of a fraud to sponsor anyone, but I wasn't willing to surrender that process. You know, I think I read somewhere in the literature that says, find someone who has what you want. And I just read to find someone, and I took it to be my responsibility. I wasn't going to let go of this process, like I wasn't letting go of much of anything else in my life. But early August, I finally got desperate enough where I could at least check the column that I need a sponsor. And I kind of look around and hopefully that no one's looking, you know, and I check it off. And 2 weeks went by, I was doing this, and no one came up to me, no one said anything, and I was almost relieved, you know. But this one Saturday morning, I was riding my bike home from a meeting in my other fellowship, and I went right by this church where we had a meeting, but it was always a half an hour into the meeting, so I never liked to go there late. I know today that half a meeting is better than no meeting, but you know, I rode right by there with not a thought in my mind, and I swear to God that 200 feet past that church, that bicycle turned around at a gas station and went back, and there was not a bit of premeditation. But I went back to that church and I walked in, and there was a man who was sharing at the time I got there, and I never met this guy before. But he was the only other guy at the meeting, so after the meeting, I went up to him, I kind of make small talk, and about 30 seconds into our little chit-chat, he said, do you need a sponsor? And I didn't think that was the way it was supposed to work, you know, but I kind of knew I was cornered, because he must have seen the We Care list. As it turns out, he never saw the We Care list, but what his sponsor had told him was that, mister, when you moved to Albany, you just moved to Albany, he said, if you don't get sponsees quickly, you're going to eat again. That's how blunt his sponsor was. And he said, if you wait for those guys to come up to you and ask, he says, you'll be sitting there, I'll be polite, but you'll be holding your you-know-what for a long time if you wait. So I got that mindset at that point in time, which has probably been a key to my progress. I said, what's the worst he can do to me? And I said, okay. And he said, well, first of all, we went over to a Howard Johnson's restaurant, which was the scene of some of my worst disasters. And I really felt kind of odd sitting there ordering decaffeinated tea, because he told me, he gave me the plan. He said, if you do what I do, I can help you. He said, if you don't, I can't help you do anything else. He said, this is my experience. And his story was a lot different than mine. He'd grown up as a chubby kid and you know, into his 20s, he was fat. And he'd been abstinent for a year and a half at that point. And he laid out the plan and the disciplines. He said, He said, get on your knees every morning and ask God for a day of abstinence. And I don't know why that struck me as such a novel thing. I've been going to the other fellowship for a while, and they tell you that too. You know, get on your knees. Well, again, I wasn't one to believe that anyone was really listening, but if that was the case, that first morning, Sunday morning, I did that. Why was I so terrified? I could barely get the words out. You know, if I didn't believe that there was someone listening, you know, and all I was able to do was ask for the abstinence, and recite essentially what the 11 steps said. Today, he and I have quite a conversation. Now I say he. You know, don't take offense. That's what I call him. I call my higher power God, Lord, today. It's because what the English language gives me. I'm not a religious person. I don't go to church or synagogue. I don't say never. But Big Book gives me permission to eventually change my thinking. You know, they say make use of what religious people have to offer. Just today, that's not part of my story. But he said to ask God for the abstinence. He said, write down your food plan every day, what you're going to do. And I started to make excuses. I work on a railroad. I'm on a rotating call board, you know, and I go to, I don't know when and where I'm going to go. But, you know, it's interesting, you know, after I made all these excuses, I realized that, you know, I had the seniority to hold regular jobs. I just liked all the commotion of being on the rotating call board. And all I had to do was call up the railroad and tell them I want to switch jobs, and I ended up with regular hours. And I found out that you can go on two-day trips and pack enough food. I carry a cooler. The same one I took on the trains with me, I carry today. I brought it with me. I have to have a reason to do something different. It says here in the Big Book, it tells me that I need to, I think it's page 100 through 102, it talks about, you know, does it mean we stay out of such places? No, if you have a good motive for being there. Well, I have to have a good motive to deviate from the plan. I did not eat with you guys today because I did not know what they were serving. Now, I do have disciplines around restaurants. That if I have a good reason to eat in one, I call them up and I can ask them, you know, do you have, I tell them I have allergies, which I do, just like my sales work described, I have an allergy. And they interpret it to be something else, though. They think that if they've served me the wrong thing, that I'm going to end up writhing in a seizure on the floor of their restaurant in front of them. And they'll tell me, and then I can make the decision. If they can't give me what I need, then I'll do something different as part of my plan. And I call my sponsor, and he makes suggestions. My sponsor, you know, I can't make my current sponsor. I can't make excuses to him. He travels too. He travels two or three times a month. Sometimes he drives, sometimes he flies. I fly a lot, you know, and I take this little cooler with me, and I check it, put it in with my check baggage. I kind of chuckle when I see it come on the conveyor belt, you know. But it works, you know. There's been no close calls. There's no slips, you know. A slip is if I walk down the street and I hit a banana peel and, you know, and I land on my back. I've never had a case, and, you know, even when I was back, you know, doing my thing, my breaches were not slips, you know. I never landed on my back, and a slip would be, I think, if I landed on my back and someone dropped a boatload of food on me and I accidentally swallowed something. Every time food went into my mouth that didn't belong there, it was a conscious decision that I made. No one forced the food down my throat. No one told me, you know, made me do anything. You know, I haven't had, when I go to these events, and believe me, I work for my union now full time, and they do a lot of conventions and buffets, you name it. We just had all of our local delegates into Missouri, and they wined them and dined them for 3 days. And I ate my dinner at home, and I went over to the country club one day and sat with them, and no one got upset that I was sitting there, wasn't eating there. You know, I can have fellowship with people today. I'm at one with you people, whether I'm eating the food with you or, breaking bread with you or not. And I never thought I could. Well, I couldn't look you in the eye, even when I was doing everything you were doing. I was eating everything other people were eating and drinking when other people were drinking. I couldn't look you in the eye. And I could look people in the eye today. I could look myself in the eye today. My sponsor, again, gave me the disciplines to do. He told me to read a particular, it's a 24-hour-a-day book. He told me to read that every morning. And I know it's not a conference piece of literature anymore, but told me to make a phone call him every morning, and if he couldn't get a hold of him to get, call an AA or OA rather. Told me to go to so many meetings a week, and the bottom line was, I thought, what's the worst can happen? And the worst that happened is I got a different life today. I wanted that first meeting we had, and I laugh when I think about this. I'm one of these people, when you start to tell me what to do, I want you to know how well I'm doing. Now, mind you, I was absolutely in sheer desperation, yet as he's telling me how to do this, I'm telling him what I'm doing. And finally, I think I paused to catch my breath, and he said, Bob, let me ask you a question. He said, how well is it working for you? He finally learned how to shut me up. And I've had other people. I'm grateful that there's people that aren't blunt. If someone's hurt your feelings here, it's out of love. I really believe that. Because there's people that have, if they were kind and gentle with me, I would not have heard them. I wouldn't have done it. I remember, they have this thing about celebrating anniversaries. And most meetings you go to, they'll ask, has anyone celebrated an anniversary this month? Well, my anniversary in this fellowship's on the 29th of the month, and on the other one, it's on the 23rd of February. So, I got about 2 days, 5 days that I can raise my hand in all false humility, say, me. Well, one meeting I went to one day, the guy said, is there anyone celebrating an anniversary this month? And he didn't make it in past tense. He said, is anyone celebrating? Well, this is like the fifth of the month. And I raised my hand and trying to be as humble as I knew I wasn't. I said, well, I'll have 3 years on the 23rd. And I hear this growl behind me that says, and keep it to yourself, goddammit, till the 23rd, thank you, Lord, because I've needed those voices. And I know they're done out of love, because I would never say anything to offend you, because I want you to like me, even though I know that if you got to know me, you wouldn't. That was my mindset. And I'm going to tell you one other action that happened. I'm not going to go on for much longer. I'm going to tell you one other significant change that happened in my life. And I'll tell you what this last change has done for me. I don't know if someone was at a meeting. I meet with my sponsor, my other fellowship, and his sponsees, and we do a big book study every week. I've got this book decorated with all these little bookmarks, and that's where I am either in that group or with a couple of my sponsees. But this one guy had been watching Oprah, and they were talking about a pill that supposedly if you take this pill that they're working on, it'll eliminate the phenomenon of craving. And what struck me at that moment was that I don't want that today. If you told me that there's a pill here, you take that pill and you will never, that I'll have the balance, that I'll be able to stop when my body's had enough, I won't take that today. Because what I've been given by coming to these rooms is so far better than, I've been given a different way of life. And that's what the heart of this disease is, and that's what 99% of this book is about, is changing my mindset. It's not about what happens once I pick up. Once I pick up, all bets are off. You know, this book is a waste of time. I'm not gonna read it. I'm not gonna understand it. This is about changing my whole approach to life. It's not what I just do at mealtimes. It's what I do when someone cuts me off in traffic. It's what I do when a constituent calls me up. I heard someone joke in our line of work in the union, they say 95% of railroaders come to work, enjoy their jobs, and go home to their families every day. And then the other 5% call us and bitch and whine about it. And what I do with that, tools I have today to handle that. Yeah. I get to answer certain questions every night. You know, my sponsor told me to read page 86 through 88 every night. And that's where I get to do these 11-step questions. I get to ask, have I got any resentments that have built up during the day? Is there anything I should share with someone? Was I selfish, self-seeking, or dishonest? Was I acting out of fear, or was I afraid? I look at those questions, and I answer them in writing. There's some power for me in doing that in writing. It sticks to my mind. But these disciplines came to me about 4.5 years ago. I got a sponsor, and it was in my other fellowship, and a lot of what I say, I'm going to say interchangeably, for me it's one recovery. I can't subdivide. I'm so grateful that OA considers this conference approved, because it's so applicable here. But I was attending meetings back in Buffalo, where I was living at the time, and it was one of these meetings where someone had warned me not to go there. They said they're big book Nazis, or they used it in a derogatory sense. Well, there was still a little streak of defiance in me. You tell me not to do something, and I'll show up with bells on. And I did. And what I heard, the message I heard, was people that had been surrendered to this process and had been taken through the steps the way they're laid out here. And it wasn't just listening to them, but was... there were people that clearly the room lit up when they shared. And I wanted that. And I sat in that meeting for 6 months wanting. And it worked as well as when I made decisions but took no actions, because I didn't know how to ask for help. And 6 months into this, I finally... half the problem was I was... half these guys were half my age. Most of the meeting was way younger than me. A lot of them were not only half my age, but half or a third the time abstinent, sober. So, well, I can't ask them for help. I made myself so damn different that I almost placed myself beyond help. And finally, after 6 months, there was one guy there who was about 50. I was 52 at the time. There's one guy there that I figured I could go up and ask. And I went up to him. I had this book in my hand, and I swear I was shaking. That's how scared I was. And even though I'd been in these rooms a while, and no one had ever hurt me. no pain inflicted. I was shaking when I asked him. I said, can you help me? And I have to tell you, God was right there at that moment, because his eyes lit up. Before he ever said a word, I knew it was going to be okay. And he said, Bob, he said, I would love to. He says, I've got 7 sponsees right now. He says, but Matt here can help you. And there's a young guy standing behind me. And I knew at that moment, it was again, what's the worst that can happen? I knew it was going to be okay. Matt was 3 years sober, 28 years old. And, you know, he took me through this process because it had been done for him. He sat down and he shared his experience. He read this to me. He wouldn't let me read. He read this to me and he showed me how it had changed his life. And again, it was like, where did this come from? It was stuff that had been there, but I wasn't absorbing it before. And that's what I try to do today. And I know the 12th step is just one of the biggest blessings in my life, to be able to share this. And I'm not just sharing what it takes to get a thin body, but what it takes to get a different life. And particularly when, in this fellowship, it's so tough for me to say, you know, to embrace that part of the first step that says my life's unmanageable. You know, I came here with a driver's license and a job. You know, I hadn't been jailed. Hadn't even had doctors tell me that you're going to die. You know, I mean, I came here with all the trappings that people would say, he's got a good life. I know today what an unmanageable life is, because I have a manageable life today. And I get to ask for help. The 2 most powerful words in the English language are help me. And I couldn't say them for so long. And that's why today I just jump at the chance to share this. I go to meetings. I love traveling. I've even had to surrender to that process. And I think I was telling someone when I got here, I used to, when I first started to travel, I would write away for meeting schedules, and I would sit and study these schedules, trying to figure out what was a good meeting. Now, I've never been to this town in my life, so how do I know what's a good meeting or a bad meeting? You know, I'd look for suburban meetings, though I did most of my pigging out in the middle of the city. You know. My friends in Cleveland like to say I was a Lorain Avenue drunk and a Shaker Heights, AA. You know, it made no sense. And I finally started to do what people suggested. You know, one friend of mine said, just pick the phone up, Bob. Just call. And I love doing that today. You know, I get on the phone and they tell me, go here, go there. I ended up at Fort Wayne, Indiana one day. Never been to Fort Wayne in my life. And I ended up at one of these meetings, and it was in the heart of the city. I walked in, and at that time I didn't know how this guy that greeted, he was sitting there shaking hands, and he was about a year sober. And he poked my nose into this book. And to this one sentence that's hit me so hard, is one of these sentences I never saw before. It says, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. How did he know I needed to hear that at that moment? Because I was still so full of myself. That's how I know God's in my life. And just so many things have happened that just convinced me without a shred of doubt that God's here, he's listening. And when I let go, I'll get the message. If I still hang on and I still try to manipulate and control outcomes and that, I'm not going to hear anything. You know, but it's a blessing today. I know today, I adhere to this food plan. People ask me today, well, do you still have to do this? And it's because I think Bev said the same thing. It's the direction I want to go in my life. I want it's grow or go. They tell me you can make progress here or you can regress, but there's no gressing. And I want to continue to grow. You know, God's got the actuarials worked out, and you know, so I'm believe me, I'm here for the count. Guys, I'm so grateful. Thank you for asking me to share. And that's all I got.